Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at energy and energy production today with a couple of guests. John Greenler, who comes by every couple of months, Director of Education and Outreach at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. John, great to have you back.
Always great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
And joining us as well, Ian Coxhead, who is the interim director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute, as well as a professor and department chair in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Ian, great to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry.
We will. They will be weighing in on the challenges posed by fossil fuel subsidies abroad and how these countries can balance economic development and environmental protection. Interesting topic to me. I hope it is to you as well. And if you have some questions or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And John, first, maybe you could talk a little bit about the GLBRC and the Energy Institute, just so that people know where you're coming from.
Sure. Well, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, or GLBRC, is now actually in its 10th year, really looking, in the case of the center, at how to produce sustainable liquid fuels from biomass. So moving away from corn-grained ethanol, looking at using kind of fibrous plant biomass materials or cellulosic materials to produce ethanol, and now really looking beyond ethanol to other types of fuels, so not competing with food production. And GLBRC is actually a collaboration between 8 different institutions throughout North America. The Wisconsin Energy Institute, clearly we're here more, you know, Wisconsin-based and more diversified in terms of kind of the, you know, energy systems that we're looking at. In addition to looking at transportation liquid fuels, also a lot of interest in electric power systems, and our research is based here at UW-Madison, but really I think the implications of the research that we're involved in are national, really, and global in scale.
Absolutely. And speaking of global in scale, Ian, you're a development economist, and some really cool research, I think. You look at the impacts of energy export booms, fossil fuel subsidies, carbon taxes in the developing world. And you gave a lecture in March. It was called Clearing the Air on Fossil Fuel Subsidies in the Developing World. I thought it was pretty interesting. Tell us a little about that.
Well, the issue for developing countries, of course, is that they want to accelerate economic growth. They want to make sure that the gains from that growth reach the broadest part of their population that they can. And they understand that cheap energy, that's an input into every production process, that means everything that employs people, they want to have cheap energy so as to accelerate that growth. Now, there are lots of ways to get growth going, but this has been one of the basic policy tools used by a lot of countries, especially the bigger oil importing or energy importing countries, India, mm-hmm. China, and others like that. So the argument goes like this. They say, well, first of all, we can create a lot more jobs, get a lot more economic growth if we have cheap fuel. But then there's an additional argument which with a very strong political element to it, and that is that there's a belief that subsidizing energy will not only accelerate industrial growth, but it'll also be good for the poor. It'll by controlling or reducing the prices of energy that's used for cooking or for lighting or for transportation, there's a belief that this will actually assist with poverty reduction directly as well as indirectly through job creation.
You've done some research on that. Just to talk about subsidies a minute, how generally in are the subsidies similar in developing countries to what we have here, or
they are in a very generic way? So a subsidy is like a negative tax. You just you lower the price of something relative to the market. Historically and still in many countries, the way that that operates in a developing country is the government will impose some form of price control. So, for example, they may fix the price of the pump price of fuel, and say, okay, then you can't change this unless we give you the authorization to do so. Meanwhile, the world market price is fluctuating. So if the world market price goes up and the domestic pump price stays constant, then that's a subsidy. And the bigger the difference between those two prices, the greater the rate of that subsidy.
And it goes the other way.
It can go the other way, yeah. That's
but
right.
but not very often?
Not very often, because prices tend to be pretty sticky at the pump. So they get out of date very fast, and then the world price moves along.
So you've looked a little bit at the consequences of these subsidies and controls, and they don't always work out maybe as planned?
Yeah, that's right. So there are some things that are easy to understand about these and some things that are a little more little less obvious. The easy part is that if you subsidize an input to production or consumption, then of course you give people incentives to change the way that they do things. So very fuel-intensive, energy-intensive industries do well out of subsidies, but it turns out that those industries in developing countries at least are not very job-intensive. So when you subsidize energy, you're subsidizing heavy industry like steel and stuff like that, which creates some jobs, but the really big job growth in developing countries is not an energy-intensive industries. So you change the way that the industrial growth pattern occurs. That's a direct cost. There's an indirect cost, and that is that when the government subsidizes energy prices, then it's spending tax dollars that would otherwise be spent on some other activity, like building hospitals or roads or schools. And so you get less investment in infrastructure and social services and everything else that government supports because it's committing funds to subsidies instead.
So what is the what's the solution, or is there any kind of solution to this sort of thing? Are we better, or would they be better off, say, letting the market go the way
the
free market?
Free market is a difficult thing to pin down, Larry. But where subsidies are. Specifically energy subsidies are concerned, there are better ways to do it. One of the other things that we need to recognize, of course, is that energy subsidies, by promoting more fuel use and less, and I guess not discouraging inefficient fuel use, mean more pollution per dollar of income generated. That's a local problem. As you know, China, for example, experiences huge air pollution problems from coal-burning power plants, especially in the wintertime. Coal is very cheap. The use of coal is subsidized in a whole variety of ways, and that turns up as a local economic problem, which is a health cost. So so one of the hidden costs of subsidies is that there's a lot of income which is spent doing things which just compensate for health and other environmental damages that they cause. That means that if you reduce the rate of a subsidy, you're also reducing the amount that people have to spend just to adapt to air pollution and other environmental effects.
You mentioned coal, and Rick in Harshaw has a question, I believe, relating to that. Let's go there. Rick, thank you for calling. Hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Larry. This question is specifically to Ian, the economist, and he just actually touched on one of my concerns, is what economists call negative externalities. That is, that if you impose a cost on someone else. So, for instance, here in northern Wisconsin, we have mercury poisoning in our lakes, and they've never had any industrial output into them, but simply have coal burning in around the world, depositing mercury into our lakes. So consequently, we have to restrict our fish consumption. That cost is imposed on us. So the question is, you know, how much of our depending on China, for instance, for cheap goods, how much of that can be accounted for with these negative externalities? What's the cost for the United States from our perspective? Then the second question is, isn't it true that we still subsidize fossil fuel production in this country? As an example, very inexpensive leases on the BLM lands for oil production. So it's kind of a two-part question.
Yeah. Thanks for that question, Rick. Ian, you want to comment?
Thank you, Rick. So the extent of fuel subsidies in China is pretty great. The total cost of those subsidies has been estimated by the International Energy Agency at somewhere around $40 to $50 billion a year, which would be about 10% of total energy subsidies. And that's about right, because that's about the size of the Chinese economy relative to the world economy as well. So yeah, to the extent that those subsidies lower the cost of production for Chinese industries, they do constitute a means of lowering the or raising the competitiveness of the Chinese producers relative to the U.S. Now, how big that effect is, that would be more difficult to pin down, because we're talking about one input to production in a production system which is mostly labor-intensive where exports to the United States are concerned. So the effect is probably not very – the direct effect is probably not very big. As far as U.S. subsidies are concerned, the U.S. does subsidize fossil fuel production and distribution. The estimated total of U.S. subsidies to fossil fuels is around $20 billion per year, so proportionate to the U.S. economy. Not that big, certainly a lot less than, in terms of percentage, a lot less than numbers that we see for developing countries.
Interesting.
Okay. Thank you very much. Add-on comment would be that subsidy in today's world would seem to be, as a public policy matter, unsupported. I mean, we should be, if anything, subsidizing cleaner forms of energy, and yet we continue to persist to sort of thwart that development by subsidizing what would have to be called dirty forms of fossil fuels. But thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. You want to comment on Rick's last comment?
Very quickly, Rick, you're absolutely right, of course, and it's certainly true that the trend everywhere, almost everywhere in the world, is to move away from policies that encourage fossil fuel production and use and towards renewables. So the balance is moving. How fast it's moving, well, we'll have to wait and see, I think.
I also liked Rick making the point that a lot of these policies clearly are national. In this case, we're talking about China, but frequently the implications can be global. And he was talking about mercury pollution, but clearly that's also really relevant when we look at greenhouse gas emissions that cause global warming and climate change. So it gets really tricky when we think about these policies and how they can really ripple through our global systems.
Yeah, and just as an aside, what are we at about 20? Is it 20 or 25% of our oil, for example, comes from imports? About 75% we grow our own right here.
I think the U.S. is just about in balance as far as oil is concerned. Yeah. Right now. It's changed a lot in recent years because of the expansion of shale oil production. It's been a huge increase in domestic supply.
And that it's interesting to look at, because that's a net production, but we also have to recognize a lot of times we may still want to be importing oil because of the different forms of crude and how they're used. Mm. So even though we may be producing as much oil as we need, doesn't mean we necessarily wouldn't want to be importing and or exporting at the same time.
Talking today with Ian Coxhead and John Greenler, taking a look at fossil fuel subsidies in the developing world. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, it's our monthly check-in with the weather guys. We'll talk about the Chetek tornado, the future of hurricane season, and a whole lot more with them. Right now, taking a look at fossil fuel subsidies in the developing world with our two guests, Ian Coxhead from the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, John Greenler, Director of Education Programs at the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. We'll take some more calls now. Jake in Eau Claire up next. Jake, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
So I've seen this new technology where they've been able to make petroleum by growing a certain type of algae here in the United States. I know San Diego and elsewhere, so I was wondering if your guests could speak to that, if they've looked into that, if that's a viable option moving forward.
Mm-hmm. John Greenland, let's turn to you for that.
Yeah, so, you know, liquid fuels, petroleum alternatives from algae is definitely, very significant in terms of research. It's still kind of, you know, in its infancy at this point in time. You know, with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, we're really looking more at fibrous plant biomass materials to petroleum alternatives. But, you know, that said, both, in public and private sectors, there is a lot of work looking at how algae can produce, energy dense, fuels. It's a tricky one in that we really need to look at kind of energy in versus energy out. And frankly, growing algae can actually involve a lot of energy inputs in terms of pumping and keeping everything clean. There's also frequently issues around water as a limiting resource. A lot of the algae that I think are easiest to use for these kinds of production systems, we need fresh water, and that's becoming increasingly valuable and precious. So there is actually some very interesting research out there looking at ways that we can use saltwater algae as an alternative. The other thing which is really exciting is there are a number of species of algae that can be adapted for producing oils that are, in many ways are very similar to diesel or jet fuel. You know, as we look towards the future, gasoline, I think there's increasingly we're seeing a move towards electric vehicles for cars mm-hmm. as an alternative to gasoline. But when we look at the heavy trucking industry, when we look at commercial airlines, etc., there we're going to, I think, probably continue to need energy dense liquid fuels, and algae can produce diesel like or jet fuel like compounds that we can use. So that's a great area of promise.
Hmm. Thank you very much for calling, Jake. Appreciate it. Let's go to Joe in Milwaukee next. Joe, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Somewhat of a question and somewhat of a comment, but as I understand it, the hydrocarbon chains that we get out of oil wells that aren't shale oil tend to be much longer because the molecules aren't trapped in a real fine rock sponge. So a lot of the uses for those oils that aren't trapped in stone tend to be greater. Like we can use it in like the electronics industry for, making all kinds of plastics, for example. And I'm wondering about, what your guests might have to say about that topic, because it's not all just fuel as well.
Yeah, okay. John Greenler, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, actually, I was just kind of briefly kind of intimating this earlier in that I think people tend to think of, crude oil as just kind of being generic. And in fact, there is a tremendous range, in the makeup of crude oil, depending upon where it comes from. There's a lot of diversity in all crude oils in terms of, once again, the chains of those hydrocarbons. And some are better for making gasoline, some are better for diesel. And as you're saying, some actually have more value in terms of production of plastics, etc. The other thing I will say is that there's been a lot of research in what we would call bioproducts. So once again, being able to make hydrocarbons, not from fossil fuels but from biomass materials, and once again, this is pretty similar, and it's an increasing area of research in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and elsewhere to make these high value products. It can be used for, fine lubricants, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, the list goes on. And the economic opportunity to have co-products where we're producing multiple compounds in parallel to make these more sustainable green economies economical is really important.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Ian, I wanted to turn to you for a second on this whole business of renewables. Is that having an impact? I mean, we're talking about fossil fuels in developing country. We're talking about some of the newer ways of generating energy. Is it having an impact in the international community and third world?
It is, Larry, yes. So investment in renewables running about the same rate as investment in fossil fuels in the United States right now. And in the developing world, that's a very common trend as well. So I want to talk a little bit about China.
Yeah.
China's China is, of course, the very big player in terms of developing country emissions and also growth in energy demand, because the Chinese economy is growing at about three and a half times the rate of the U.S. economy. So it's a lot of people, and it's also got much faster growth in energy demand. So a couple of things that are, I think are interesting and not very well known about China. One is that we hear a lot of press reports about huge numbers of new coal-fired energy plants being constructed in China, and that sounds like a very troubling development. The other is that we hear that China is really taking the lead in the international community on implementing commitments under the Paris Accord, the international agreement to cut carbon emissions. So on the first one, I think that's what's really interesting is, first of all, that the stock of coal-burning power plants in China is way, way cleaner because it's much newer than anything in the United States. There is no comparable stock of what's called hyper-supercritical coal-burning power plants in the U.S. There's only one such plant in the U.S. In China, about 20% of their coal-burning energy comes from such plants now. So a lot less coal getting burned for the same amount of energy produced. So first thing is that China is a big contributor, 28% of global carbon emissions, but the trend in China is towards much, much cleaner energy, first of all on the fossil fuel burning front. Secondly, China has made huge investments in solar and wind. And the more that they invest in that, the more they'll start switching their energy source over to those. They've got some big problems to overcome there, some political and institutional problems as well as infrastructure, but they're certainly making progress in that area.
Very interesting. We have more callers online. And I suppose, just to go back to China for a minute, Ian, the plants that they're constructing, these new plants. I actually talked to an engineer, someone from UW Engineering once, who said, you know, these coal, we can have pretty clean coal if we wanted to, but the cost of the plants is great.
Yeah.
And I imagine retrofitting the plants we have is also an issue.
Yeah, so the stock of U.S. Coal-burning power plants is pretty old.
Yeah.
Most of them are built between 1950 and 1990. And so the technology has moved on a long way since then. Most of the top 100 most energy-efficient plants in China are built in the last 11 years, since 2006. So very different technology being used
right
there.
Yeah, and there's, you know, as Ian was saying, there's a couple different pieces. There's this, you know, just efficiency of the plant itself, and these high temperature supercritical plants are much more efficient. And then on top of that, there's this whole other technology of carbon capture and storage, CCS. And so it is possible, when we're looking at the specifics of trying to address greenhouse gas emissions, of really being able to pull a lot of that CO2 out of the stack, so to speak. But it does come at a very significant cost, not just in terms of dollars or currency, but also in terms of the energy it takes to run that CCS technology. That's where a lot of the cost is. And so, once again, that will create less emissions, significantly reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, but it's much less efficient because you have to put all the energy into that carbon capture and storage technology. So there's a lot of interplay.
Lots
there
of trade-offs there. Okay. Mark in Richland Center, we turn to you next. Hi, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. You guys talked earlier about this Great Lakes Biomass Energy Group and the question with regard to fossil fuels compared to biofuels is, do you know what percentage of fossil fuels are currently being replaced by bios? Because originally, and I think the biofuels are almost exclusively for liquid fuel, and that's almost exclusively in the transportation part of the energy usage of the society. But diesel, the guy who invented the diesel engine, had intended to use biofuels, and so did Henry Ford when he started making automobiles. So what percentage of the transportation fuel system can be realistically replaced with biofuels, and how soon can we get there?
Yeah, there's a lot to that question, and I think you can look at it a couple different ways. Just looking at terms of the United States and our current technology in terms of of biofuels, liquid bioenergy, essentially. You know, when we go to the pump and we're filling our cars, clearly at this point in time, the vast majority of us are using E10, which is essentially 10% ethanol. It's interesting to kind of look on the back end of that system. Most people don't realize that. I think most people understand that that's coming from corn grain. Most people don't realize that, on average, give or take, about 40% of our corn harvest currently is going into producing that ethanol to get that 10% ethanol. And then just to make things more interesting, we really ultimately need to be looking at how much energy goes into producing that ethanol so we can kind of look at what we would call a net energy balance. That continues to improve as those ethanol plants are getting more efficient, but I will say that it still takes a significant amount of energy to get from corn grain to ethanol. I think we're getting more out than we're putting in at this point in time, but through, for example, using fibrous plant biomass, the cellulosic technology, we have the opportunity to bring that down, have a much more efficient system. But really, at this point in time, we do have some commercial scale cellulosic plants that are out there, but they're really still in their infancy and not really a significant amount of our total liquid fuel consumption. Just briefly, if we look more globally, for example, we went to Brazil where they use sugarcane to produce ethanol. There, the numbers are much larger. They're producing somewhere, it varies depending upon their sugarcane harvest, but it can be, 30 to 50% of their liquid fuels in any one year are actually coming from biofuels. So it varies widely.
Primarily.
Yeah, exactly, which is a perennial grass.
Mm-hmm. And actually, there's an interesting tropical country analog to that as well, and that is that the fruit of the oil palm is a very good feedstock for biodiesel as well. Mm-hmm. And in past years, when world oil prices have been very high, there's been huge expansion of oil palm plantations in tropical countries, especially in Indonesia, which is by far the world's biggest oil palm producer. And that brings its own problems, because when they expand oil palm plantations, they are burning forests, which involves a significant amount of carbon release, as you can imagine. So this is really a two-edged sword as far as biofuels are concerned.
Mm. Yeah, the calculations, in some cases, it can take hundreds of years to literally pay off the carbon debt of actually clear-cutting that forest. It's really very devastating.
Yeah. Thanks again, Mark, for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. And also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's go to Mike in Madison next. Mike, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, what's basically the cost of everybody, burning fossil fuels in their automobiles and taking jet airplanes everywhere, just like this last Memorial Day, keeps going up. It's always a record, and it's cumulative from year to year. So, for example, carbon dioxide is now above 400 degrees numbers part per million in the atmosphere. So every year it keeps going up, and that's why we're seeing the oceans rise and get more acid. So one question I had is whether the oceans are taking in more mercury now, because when they get more acid, they get more earthy. The other thing is I have a proposal to reward people instead of taxing more. You reward people who don't use their cars so much or fly in airplanes, and you can read about it at allthingsenvironmental, that's all one word, .com.
All right. Well, get some comments from our guest. Ian, we'll start with you.
Mike, you've identified a really significant problem, which is the damage being done to the world's oceans by greenhouse gas emissions. They have acted as a huge sink for carbon, and the increasing acidification, the loss of the polar ice caps, and, of course, the rising sea levels and rising sea temperatures are all very clear indicators of the kinds of damages that we're experiencing now and that we will bequeath to our grandchildren. So how do we prevent that from happening? Well, cleaner technologies is part of the solution, but as you've identified, it also matters that we change the behavior of individuals and companies and countries where energy use is concerned. And so any kind of incentive that you can give people to conserve energy, any kind of reward that you can give them to use less energy, make good choices, even at the household level, all of those things add up and they all matter.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Mike. I want to give Roger in Poinette a chance to join in. Roger, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry. I was going to circle back to the issue about growing corn for ethanol. An issue that you guys didn't discuss is the fact that corn is probably the most thirsty plant that we can put on the ground. It uses more water than anything else and also probably as much fertilizer or more than the other plant. And any other substitute would be better, but I suppose because of the politics with corn and agriculture and the industry making these corn seeds, it's a tough road to hoe.
Well, John Greener, let's turn to you for a comment.
Yeah, well, a tough road to hoe, I think, is a good way of putting it, and I think you're pointing out some really good details here in terms of looking at corn grain production, because you're right, you know, corn does require a lot of inputs, and some of those inputs do require energy and other resources as well. Water for irrigation is very significant, and I think increasingly we're going to see and further appreciate how limited our water resource is, especially when it comes to freshwater. And clearly fertilizer is kind of another hidden input in terms of corn production. And what most people don't realize is that with the main fertilizer being nitrogen, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to make nitrogen fertilizer, and that's a big expense. And when we do a kind of a life cycle assessment, you know, cradle to grave, looking at corn grain ethanol, and we look at those energy inputs through nitrogen fertilizer, they're tremendous. That said, when we look forward to things like cellulosic biofuels, you know, we get to looking at perennial crops such as switchgrass, which we can grow on what are known as marginal lands, acreage where it wouldn't be good to grow grain crops. And switchgrass requires a lot less irrigation because it has these deep roots as a perennial. And the other thing is through the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and elsewhere, there's been some really exciting results to demonstrate essentially that once we establish that switchgrass crop, we really kind of can bring the need for nitrogen inputs essentially to zero. There are fungi in the soil which can take nitrogen out of the atmosphere. You give those plants enough time to develop an association, with that fungi, and essentially you can really just, you know, cut free from having to bring nitrogen fertilizer into the system. So, the good news is we've got some solutions out there to move forward with sustainable biofuels.
And just thinking about research, Ian, you're the interim director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Talk about some of the work that's going on in your neck of the woods.
Well, the Energy Institute is built around a core of just fabulous basic scientific research that John has already described, most notably the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. So that's the kind of the number one scientific research activity taking place there. Not the only one, of course. Mm-hmm. There are several others. But what's been really interesting for me and what's been a great opportunity for me as interim director and as an economist is that I was asked to try to broaden the mandate of the Institute a little further. We're on a very fabulous, rich university campus here with all kinds of great ideas going on and all kinds of people working on energy from every angle, not just the basic scientific research angle. And so integrating across the campus, getting the scientists talking to the social scientists, mm-hmm. talking to the policy people, and going beyond that is a really big challenge. It's hard to get people talking across outside of their mm-hmm. own departments, but the potential gains from doing that are huge. If we can have one conversation about energy and make sure that what's regarded as a good idea by, say, a biochemist is also seen as a viable idea by someone in the policy sphere, then I think we have the chance to make real progress. And yeah. So I think the Energy Institute is working towards being a landing pad for all of these conversations on campus and out into the community as well.
Yeah, great ideas. Dale in Cottage Grove, it's your turn next. Hi, Dale. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We live in a disposable economy and a disposable world, and what about all the millions of vehicles that have already been produced? Is there any way to retrofit them and re-engineer the engines that they have to adopt new technology? Because there are going to be so many millions of poor people around the world that aren't going to be able to afford this new technology. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Yeah. Well, let's turn John Greenler, go to you first.
Sure. Yeah, I really appreciate Dale's question because, once again, I think most people don't realize what we call embodied energy. You know, the inputs it takes just to get your vehicle, et cetera, is really tremendous, and we really need to account for that when we think about, for example, you know what the cost is for us, the greater cost for us to be able to drive a mile in our car, et cetera. So, you know, once again, coming back to the biofuel story, as we look towards, you know, the future. We're really looking beyond ethanol and towards what we would call drop-in fuels. So these are fuels that really can directly take the place of gasoline or diesel and jet fuel. So you really wouldn't need to be able to significantly modify that internal combustion engine. Or just as importantly, is kind of looking further upstream, the infrastructure that it takes to get, for example, that fuel to the pump, you know, to the filling station, to the pump, to be able to put in your car. The more we can be able to utilize that existing infrastructure, the more economical it's going to be, and also the more environmentally friendly and sustainable it's going to be as well.
Hmm. And Ian, Carl from Menominee Falls emailed to say he noted that on Google search you can find all kinds of studies sort of lambasting ethanol in terms of energy in, energy out. However, it's difficult to find studies that examine the same for the fossil fuel industry. The oil industry, from that standpoint, needs to be studied much further. You comment?
I think if you keep searching, you will, Carl, find a lot of studies on the environmental impact of fossil fuel mining and fossil fuel burning. That's a very, very big issue, of course, at the very center of our current global debates about global warming and what to do about that.
Yeah, and the subsidies.
Yes.
As well. Sue from Mequon asks for a recommendation for some good books on the subject, ones that are good for a non-science community. Any recommendations for books or other materials? I know you have materials up on the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center as an example. Maybe talk about that for a minute.
So we have a lot of materials on the web for the general public to be able to consider these concerns. In terms of biofuels and bioenergy, I would direct people to glbrc.org. And then more broadly, in terms of energy, the website for the Wisconsin Energy Institute, energy.wisc.edu, is a great place to go. But let me also offer, if somebody wants to email me, to find a resource on a particular topic or whatever, I'd be glad to try and help out. And john.greenler, G-R-E-E-N-L-E-R, at wisc.edu. Be glad to help out.
And you're on the website, so if people
exactly.
don't get that, they can go to the...
Find me on the website for sure. Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Well, Ian, you were...
I would just add, if you're interested in international topics specifically, then a really good web resource is the website of the International Energy Agency. Mm-hmm. That's IEA.org. They have a lot of reports. Some of them are pretty technical, but there's also a lot of much more accessible material there. I think it gives you a good snapshot of what's going on worldwide and in specific countries as well.
IEA.org.
That's right.
Yep. Well, good interactive web materials for sure. Yeah, it's a good site.
Guys, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Ian, great to see you again.
Thanks, Larry.
And John, always great. You'll be back on July 31st.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Larry.
We'll see you again. Thank you so much. Ian Coxhead, Interim Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute, also professor and chair in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. John directs education programs for the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Interesting stuff. We'll talk some more with them for sure. But coming up, Well, it's not the last Monday of the month. It's the last Tuesday of the month. And our weather guys are coming back a day late, but not a dollar short. We'll be talking with them about the Chautauqua tornado, summer weather outlook, and a whole lot more. So you stay with us.